Thanks, Rob.
Okay. I'm Reese Quinn, a professor at University of Mississippi. I'm on Yon G minus two. I'm serving as the convener of Community Engagement Frontier with Kitevi. And my background in this is I've been doing the DC trip for 16 years or so.
I can go next.
I can go second. Sorry. I'm Matheus Carneiro. I'm a postdoc at Brookhaven National Lab, mostly work with neutrinos. In terms of snow mass, I'm mostly involved in the community engagement frontier, mostly in the early career groups. And my background in this term, it's more about, I was part of the DC trip two or three times, I believe. And besides that, it's just a matter of like personal experiences with the subject.
Corinne?
I'm Corinne Mills. I'm an assistant professor at University of Illinois Chicago with a joint appointment to Furry Lab. I've been doing the DC trip off and on for the last 4 years. I think I've been four or five times. And I am I'm the vice chair of the US LHC Users Association. And I've been on three different collider physics collaborations over the years. So I guess lived abroad. And so I guess one of the things I bring to the table is that I know a lot of people and have been a lot of places.
Hi, everyone. I'm Elena Gramellini. I'm a Lederman Fellow at Fermilab. I've been on the Fermilab trip a few times, I think two. I was an international student for a long time. I did my PhD in the US, even if I'm originally from Italy. And my experience in this field is, I'm a neutrino physicist that came from collider physics. So I've been around places, I would say, as well. My personal experience is the DC trip and being an international student here.
Thanks. Okay, I will share my slides and give a just brief introduction. Let me share my screen. So I hope you all see that. So first, just some quick guidelines for discussion. I think you're aware of this. For this meeting, like all the other ones that we're holding, we'll follow the corporate principles put together by the UPF Export, as well as the LPS Code of Conduct. And then here is just a couple of big bullet point reminders to be seen. So we'll use Zoom hand raising. Please be mindful and respectful of each other in the conversation. We are, as I said, we'll mention again in a few slides, separate out the different areas in this topic into a few broad categories, and we're separating different meetings based on those. So if you can, please try and keep the conversation to what we're discussing today in order to enable conversation in this area and use the time as best as we can. And then just be respectful of your colleagues, even if you don't agree with them. Everyone has a right to be heard. And make sure that everyone has given it an opportunity to talk. If we don't get to all the questions, we can do the conversation onto our Slack channel. And as you hopefully now know, that we plan to record this meeting, we'll upload it to the Indigo site later. But if you do not wish that for you to be recorded, let us know and we'll not do that. Okay. So I think everyone who's here in attendance knows the point of this group. So we're the public policy and government engagement. So we're kind of covering all aspects of meeting both with the federal banks and the legislative branch as we've discussed a few times, sort of the big activity that's historically happened has been this yearly trip to meet with Congress. And there's been less formal activities aimed at the federal branch and basically no formal activities aimed at like local, state or other levels. The fun, you know, the activities that have happened so far have focused around high energy physics funding and generally occasionally emphasizing other areas, which such as, you know, education and STEM, but no formal policies in those fronts, just a statement of these, you know, that high energy physics has a benefit on those areas, never advocating for a specific policy in those areas. The mechanism where that happens currently is through the APS. So not specifically through DPF, because they actually have their own selection of rules that come through them, through the APS, who has its own government relations team. And I'm sure everyone on this call has seen, you know, the letter writing campaigns that have come out through the APS. There was one recently in relation to the visa changes and the due to the pandemic, not allowing people to retain their visas if they want to have online classes. There was one when the first Covenant president's, President Trump's budget came out, showing a very large cut to the Office of Science budget. So these are not just dependent on activities which they're not just for areas which are just for high-energy physics, they're for areas which are for, you know, the entirety of, well, you know, both the Office of Science and the NHS, because they sit under APS. So they're not something that's not a message that we control, but it's very likely there's going to be a very strong overlap with what with that and what we currently, what we would choose to advocate for if we choose to do it. Just a reminder of the four groups that we, four topics we've split this group into. So each of these have dedicated meetings on them. So the first one is this engagement with Congress on high energy, on HEP advocacy and funding. What we generally is referred to as the DC trip. So that's the main area that's focused in that. Engagement with Congress on other topics that impact HEP. So this is, you know, diversity, visas, STEM education, other areas where you can say things have a, you know, the policy decisions have a direct impact on us. We wouldn't be the only people advocating for them, most likely. And it would be a new kind of an additional effort, which we don't currently have. So this meeting is focused on. We have two other topics, which are engagement with other government agencies. So this is both engagement with federal agencies, the DOE, NSF, OSTP, and OMB within the executive branch, as well as, you know, funding efforts with state and local government. And then our fourth topic is everything related to training and education, both educating our community about the importance of these efforts and educating our community about how to get them, you know, maximize the what they can get out of the time they put into these efforts. So we said, I'll just put these meetings about the details about the meetings here. We had them every other Wednesday, and all the Indigo is on Indigo on the Google calendar. One additional thing to bring up is for the upcoming planning meeting, there will be a plenary session, which will be contain a panel discussion containing all of the liaisons from the different frontiers. And we are asking for people to think of specific, you know, public policy and government relation questions, which can be asked during that panel discussion to the liaisons. So if you have, we'll send out an email as well with more details about this. But if you can be thinking if there's anything specific that you want to be asked to in that panel session, just send us an email or a Slack message with your question. Okay, so this is the start of the introduction. I can't actually see participants, so I'll pause for a second to see if there are any hands up. So I don't see any hands. So the next part of the conversation, we had put together just a couple of starter questions that will go to the four panelists to start the conversation. And then after that, we'll open it up to general conversation and general questions. Uh, The panelists have already introduced themselves, so I'll slip the slide. Okay. And here we've just written out some of the questions on the slides. Okay, so I will, I guess I'll keep sharing this, but I'll stop sharing so people can see the panelists, because I think that'll be more interesting than looking at these questions, and then I'll read them out. Okay. And now I need to get my slides back up again. Okay, so then the first question we have says, there is governmental policy distinct from budget process, which directly impacts the HET community and often directly impacts individuals within the community. What role do you think is appropriate for the community and individuals of the community to take in advocating for those interests, these specific policies? I don't know if there's anyone who wants to feel they want to jump in on this, or I can direct it to someone. Maybe I should direct it to Bruce to start us off.
Okay. So this is sort of the big question, and how broadly we should spread out our attention to individual issues, and the thing is that there are an unlimited number of issues that could directly impact individuals in the HEP community, right? I mean, a completely unlimited set of issues. So how do you decide which ones to do, or for any organization that, for that matter? And my perspective on it is that, generally speaking, a given organization should limit its advocacy efforts according to a couple of criteria. One being that the issue does directly impact that community, and generally impact it in the scope of that community's activity. Okay, for example, everyone in the HEP community is impacted by fiscal tax policy, right? But that isn't a direct impact on the operation of high energy physics, the high energy physics endeavor. And it's probably not something that we should wade into. So the issue is directly pertinent to that organization in the scope of that organization's activities. And second, that in general, focus on issues in which that organization could expect broad agreement from its members, but not just broad agreement from its members, but broad agreement from its members simply by virtue of the fact of their membership in that organization. And so I think that those are two good criteria to apply to decide which issues a given organization should apply its advocacy efforts to. As we go into some of the other questions, I think some of the other questions will deal with things that relate to that and sort of flesh that out a little bit. But those are sort of the criteria I look at.
Thanks, Bruce. Does anyone one of the panelists want to jump in?
Luis, should we raise our hand or?
And there's only four of you. I was just assuming you could just go for it. But if you'd like to, if you think it would be easier to raise your hand. Go ahead, Eleanor.
Yeah. So there's a few things that what you just said made me think. I think the main is, who gets to decide what are the topics that are directly impacting the scope of our scope? Because at the beginning of what you said, you said, well, there's an infinite amount of personal issues that you could delve into, and that is true, but there's a number of issues that maybe affect a big portion of our community, not necessarily, you know, like the single person, but well, many single people. That's what I was trying to say. Mm-hmm. And these issues might be student debt. That's student debt. That's one thing that came to mind. Another one could be immigration policies. And then one can say, well, you take these two issues and then you think, well, do they have a direct impact on you know, like you go with your criterion that I think it's a good criterion, but it's the devil is in the details. How do these topics or issues affect directly our scope? And I see arguments for yes and no. Like, no, I mean, like you can do technically, you need the machine. Why like you need money to do the machine? But yes, because we do a better science when we have people that from very different experiences. I think as an Italian person, I brought things that I learned in Italian academia. I thought that immigration policies are very complicated for me, have a direct impact for me. But I came here without any debt. And the issue of student debt is crippling for many good people that want to stay in our field but need to carry on with what they have. So, like, who gets to decide what topic directly impact the community? It's interesting and it's complicated.
Yeah. I completely agree with Elena, and I agree with Breeze. Like those standards are really good, but as Elena was saying, it's like it's really hard to define those things. Like if you go to the low hanging fruit that is immigration, I think it's very easy to make the point that affects our community in several different levels, right? Like, I don't know, like a postdoc that accepted a position in February of 2020 right now, because of the pandemic, of course, but also because of immigration, this is a problem to the institution, is a problem to that group that counted, that made plans to have an extra person they don't have. It's a problem, a personal problem to that person because, right, like they made plans of moving and everything. And that's not happening. So there are low-hanging fruits that we could definitely fight for as a community, and I don't think it's hard to make those points. But when you get to things like I don't know, if you're gonna talk about women's rights or LGBTQ people's rights, that affects a big, like there's a big chunk of the community that now have a whole extra problem that is related to the government that it will somewhat affect the way we work, and not just the way we work, but affect the way people take decisions. So because people don't have parental leaving, they may just literally make the choice of dropping out of a position or not because they want to prioritize their personal life and their family. Of course, we're not going to get everything perfect for everyone, but I think I agree with the check boxes we need to mark, but those things can be very blurry lines. And there are things that we are already agreeing to a level, but I think we need to be more responsible about it. If we have codes of conduct, right? There is an APS code of conduct that literally says and states that we all support diversity and inclusion. So we say that, but then we don't put our mouth where that is, in the sense of like, so we support diversity and inclusion, but then we're not gonna say anything once a policy really like endangers a big part of that community that we say we fight for. So we all agree with that code of conduct, right? These things get really blurry and complicated. But.
Karen, do you want to add anything?
I don't have too much to add, and I'm actually just going to contribute another question. I was reading a little bit recently about the complicated issue of the American academic community bringing Jewish people out of Germany and surrounding areas during World War II, and I'm wondering if there are, and you can argue that that directly affects the community. What Brees outlined is a very good standard. The question I'm going to add is, are there things that would rise to the level of a moral emergency where you would want to use, even if it's really not like this isn't about physics, is are there places where we would want to use our organization to advocate for something that doesn't directly affect us just because there's not, it seems not like an option to be quiet?
Yeah, one thing I would point out in my comments is that the words that I started off with were generally speaking. And so I think those are good criteria, generally speaking. But there are extraordinary cases. There are absolutely extraordinary cases. And so that's, you know, where I would go past that is that those criteria would not be exclusionary, but general criteria that we use. But for extraordinary cases where we, you know, as a community feel that the community needs to make a statement, needs to make some kind of push, as we'll get to a little bit later on one of the questions, there need to be very specific mechanisms for making those choices, like Elena was talking about, who gets to make the choices, and not just who, but how. And there has to be very specific, you know, mechanisms in place that are transparent and known about ahead of time to apply to be able to make those choices. And that was sort of the point of the criteria of being, you know, on issues that have direct impact, and in which you can expect broad agreement from the community by virtue of someone's membership in that community. For those things, like, we don't poll the field before we go on the DC trip, because we can expect broad agreement from the HEP community to support increased funding for HEP, simply by virtue of the fact that our community members are in HEP, right? And so on something like that, I don't think we need to go poll, you know, the community or employ some mechanisms to go figure out what our position is. But for something outside of those criteria, there's got to be some mechanism of deciding where we're going to stand, how much, and in what way we're going to apply these resources. And so, I absolutely agree. Hence the generally speaking, other than, you know, more extraordinary circumstances.
That actually brings us very well into the second question that we had written down, which was, if HEP was to advocate for other areas, taking aside the section for now about whether or not we should, what mechanism do you think the community should use to decide on which areas of policy to advocate more? You know, and then a follow on, how do we ensure there's enough community-wide consensus on these topics or policies? I can pick on someone or someone can jump up. Mateus, do you want to start us off?
Sure, sorry. Can you repeat the question? I'm just trying to find which of the questions you addressed me.
It's like, if HEP was to advocate for other areas of government policy, what mechanism do you think that the community should use to decide on which areas of policy to advocate so often, and what rises to that level? And if so, how do we ensure there's enough community-wide consensus? You know, is it 100% consensus? Do we say, you know, is it 50% consensus? You know, a lot of policies can be, a lot of areas we agree on, but specific policies we might not agree on. So there's certain areas where immigration or diversity, we often as a community would say, yes, we agree on this. But then when you take it the step further to say, okay, now this bill is being written into law, there are multiple ways you take it forward. And generally when you advocate behind you, you know, for a specific area within Congress, you advocate for a policy. So then you have this additional complication. How do you decide which policy do we agree on, instead of just taking it onto which area do you agree on? Or do we ignore that and just try to do general advocacy for visa issues without trying to mandate which specific changes should happen? That was a long a little long question.
Yeah, sorry, I just got lost. I just got lost in my list. Yeah, I think there is, right, like what Breeze just mentioned, that we don't pull people, when we don't pull the whole community when we go advocate for it. But that's, I mean, it's true if we were going there to just ask for money. But if we do more than that, right? Like we go there and we ask for funding in specific areas because we had this no mass process that is the whole process of trying to pull in the whole community and trying to get to things that somewhat there is a consensus on, right? So I think that we already have some, like for the DC trip, there is already some sort of process on that as well, that maybe we can try to work that. If you look at snow mass community engagement, if we have a whole group that is literally about diversity and inclusion, maybe we can try to use that, this snow mass as itself, to try to come up with what the community consent in general. I think it's very complicated to try to get to the, as was just mentioned, of having specific policies that we fight for and against. Of course, there are very specific cases, like the cases that you mentioned in the beginning, that directly affect the community in terms of immigration, because it's sort of a decision that broadly screws up a huge part of the community. But I know that can get very complicated to get to specific points. So I think we should aim more as a community into general advocacy, right? Like we should, and there are other, there are organizations of scientists that already do that, right? Like you have the Scientists Concerned, sorry, I always forget their name, but it's the Scientists.
Union of Concerned Scientists, I think.
Union of Concerned Scientists. I think it's a horrible name, but still, there are organizations of people that they fight for things in a more general sense, and I think that that's something that is way easier for us to do. And I don't know, as I mentioned before, there are already sort of things that we virtually agree on. Codes of conduct are things that we have been all signing on when we get, like the APS one is something that we all sign on. So on that document, there are things that we could specifically advocate for. And if people in the community do not agree with it, then the problem is before that. Then the problem is putting together that code of conduct. So I think we already have points that we could aim for and things that we could somewhat easily consider that there is some sort of consent.
I have a slightly different take, I guess, or I have a slightly different concern. When we put together conducts or we're discussing about some broader issue, it's very difficult to disagree, or at least I find that as a community, we don't deal well with disagreement. We don't know how to do it particularly well, which is astounding to me, because I think that science is based on disagreement. Like, is based on the fact that I put forward my idea and then you poke holes into my ideas, and then we come up with an idea that is better. I think the history of our field tells us over and over again that we are not doing that very well. And we are not doing very well in a way that that is respectful of the diversity of thought. And so while I, you know, like when we get into issues like women's rights, people of color's rights, you enter in a very difficult field, and the type of disagreement that you can have reflects pretty poorly in the judgment that people have of you. So I find it very difficult to to talk about some of the issues without being judged. And this comes from, I think, both part, well, no matter the stand that you have. I'm saying this, and I think this is relevant because of the practicality of what we're thinking about, meaning like if you have a policy and you need to, and if you're looking at a policy and you're trying to find consensus in the community on a given policy, the way that you word things, the way that you ask for a change, what change to ask needs to be agreed on. And if we don't know how to come to a consensus, that's a real problem.
Yeah, the question of mechanisms is pretty tricky, and it gets more so as, you know, as Louise was mentioning, when you get to the level of specific legislation, and for the reasons that have been mentioned. And so, you know, we mentioned these words consensus, right? Well, how do you define consensus? You know, is it a poll that reaches a supermajority of 67%, you know, on an issue, or is consensus higher than that? Is it, you know, 90%? You know, where's your criteria to say that we have reached consensus? And then, you know, and is it just going to be a supermajority of those who responded to the poll, or a supermajority of the field, the members of the field? And because if you've got if you've got 3,000 people in your community and 30 of them responded to the poll, but they responded, you know, positively for the issue, is that really representing the field? And so if you can't get a certain threshold percentage of the population to respond, then, you know, obviously it's not, you know, there's a lacking of demonstration of broad support for that issue. And so you've got to get very specific. And I don't mean that there is a lack of support for the issue, but there would be a lack of demonstrated support for the issue.
I disagree on this.
Well, you have to have something to show that you have demonstrated support. I'm not saying that's the only way to do it, but there has, you know, if you're wanting to show consensus on a subject, you have to have something to show that demonstrates consensus. No, that's all I'm saying.
No, I agree. But if you put up a machinery that...
And so there have to be clear mechanisms in place for how we show that, how we make those criteria decisions. And then when we talk about, you know, what kind of advocacy we do, there are two types of things. One is advocating for specific legislation, like we do in the DC trip, you know, like APS does for specific immigration policies and this, that, and the other. But then there are things that organizations do, for example, on, you know, releasing statements on an issue. And, you know, and that's done through separate mechanisms. But again, the APS releases statements on various issues from time to time. But there are mechanisms and there are specific policies in place for how those get determined. You know, who makes it, as we mentioned earlier. You know, the council, you know, votes on these things. And so those things would all have to be, you know, determined and approved of. You know, just like, you know, the as Mateus was mentioning earlier about the codes of conduct and everything, you know, the way that we know we have demonstrated support for that policy of code of conduct is that it has been approved through the processes that are in place to generate those policies. And so so those just have to be defined.
Yeah. Eleanor, you had a comment you wanted to make.
Well, I think that I agree on the fact that we need a mechanism, but when the mechanism, if it's a widely known mechanism that this is how we decide on a certain topic and no one responds to a poll, well, it means, it doesn't mean necessarily that you don't have an agreement. It means that that part of the community is okay with whatever outcome the poll has, which is also a stand. And I don't see, you know, like when you vote on something in a democracy, you care about you count the number of people that respond, not the number of people that not the percentage of responses. So I don't that point I don't agree with. Like if you
well, that wasn't what I was meaning. That I was saying that you have to define what that criteria is. In our democracy, our criteria is you have an election, and no matter how many people vote in it, whoever has the majority wins it, and that determines it. And all I'm saying is that you need to define what that process is ahead of time. And I was asking, I wasn't saying that, you know, it wouldn't be okay for us to have a simple majority of whoever responds. You can have that as your criteria. But we as a field would have to determine if that's the appropriate criteria to define consensus, a simple majority of those who respond. Or if we think that a higher threshold needs to be reached for us to decide that consensus has been reached. Not that one or the other is the one that we should do, but it has to be defined ahead of time.
Corinne, do you want to chime in?
I don't really have much to add on this one, except that I will, to Mateus's point, adopting the codes of conduct in the last few years has not been without controversy. Mm-hmm. There have been objections.
Yeah, sorry, if I can answer that. Like, it's true, but in the end, they were approved, right? Like, I think to talk what Ellen and Brice were also saying, like, I think some of those things are already in place. When the APS put out a statement that refers on how we are against the immigration policies that just came out, they didn't poll the whole community to ask for that. That is a, right, like, it is a representative democracy in a way. Like those, we have leaders that somewhat understand that that's the case, and they decided, right, like in their internal leadership organization, that I would even say that I'm not fully even understand how that goes. But there is a decision made by leaders that's a problem to the community. So we all behind APS somewhat support that. So yeah, like I think if that's the case for immigration, in a sense, why that cannot be the case for other things that may also be somewhat controversial. I completely agree. We need to define the standards of what we define as a consensus. But I think that somewhat already exists. We elect representative leaders, and they could take that stand as they do. APS like put out a statement saying something, and also opens up a structure for people to individually chime in, right?
That actually takes us quite nicely into our own question, to the next question. Sorry, Eleanor, go ahead. I guess you've got you.
Yeah. You're right. One thing that I always think about when APS puts out a statement is how effective that is. And because it, well, you know, like it's definitely a feel good part from the receiving end. Like the one of the latest immigration, well, I want to take as an example one of the latest immigration issues as like kind of a case study. The one regarding reverting some of the privileges that were granted at the beginning of the pandemic regarding on-site, on American soil, presence of students. And personally, even though I'm a postdoc, I'm under the same regulation because of crazy immigration rules. And my husband is still a student, and he was very much affected by this particular issue. So you know, like you read, like we read the statement from ICE and completely ruined our day, of course. And it was really, it felt very good reading APS saying, what is this? This is completely against what we stand for our field and all of that. I wonder though, in this particular case where the policy was reverted, if what happened, like meaning what really made the decision change, and I wonder if it's like the state broad statements or MIT, Harvard, and like a consortium of universities suing the government. And so, you know, like, we have a hard time reaching a consensus on statement, there are some things that it's going to be hard to reach a consensus on statement, but are the statement actually effective? Like that's kind of what counts, what makes things move, because otherwise you put into place this big machinery, you get thousands of emails, hours of meetings, and then you put out a statement. And so I don't know, like that's a topic that I find interesting, I guess.
You know, it is a very bad question, right? And they, as APS in principle, have significantly more weight behind them than us, which, you know, is a bad question. We talk here about elected representation. Do we consider APS to be representative of us? We may have voted. A lot of people don't vote and aren't members of DPF because you have to specifically pick the DPF box under the APS. So, you know, that doesn't take even consider, it's not, you know, as we know from the Snowmass efforts, it's not the only APS subgroup which covers high energy physics. It also doesn't actually contain most of high energy physicists. And it's not clear that people see APS as being representative of us. On the other hand, we don't have a different elected body within the community, which I think anyone would state is, which is completely representative of us. We have the different users groups, but they are kind of somewhat more segregated to different areas. The next question we had written down kind of goes on this, you know, the currently available advocacy avenues for advocacy on behalf of the physics community is APS. As you said, the statements, and those statements often come with write-in campaigns where they give you information in order to contract your Congress people with kind of like a pre-written statement about the policy they're working for. Now, is this sufficient for our interests? Do we think that APS is representative of our interests? And do you think that we should be working towards direct advocacy that already exists in that channel instead of trying to create our own advocacy? So this we've already touched on. Corinne, do you want to start us off?
I think APS is in general a pretty good, it's going to be the biggest voice. With advocacy stuff, I think about, you know, how big is the boulder I'm trying to move and how big is the lever? You know, if there's an issue that I'm interested in, you know, if it's something I can do, if there's something I can do at my university, I have a very big lever there. You know, something like the university policy is a relatively small boulder, federal policy is a big one. And so APS is the biggest lever most of us have some kind of access to. But there also may be things that, you know, and I think our group should engage, our community should engage with those advocacy efforts. There also may be things, and I was trying to think of something where it would be very specific to HEP, something that affects, you know, not just students traveling internationally, but something about international collaboration. Like, if there were to be something that would say, okay, you know, US scientists cannot collaborate on experiments that are cited abroad, hypothetically. Like, that would be affecting us specifically. And then I think it would be very clearly appropriate for our group to have a separate advocacy effort. it may not be useful to for us to replicate things that are being done at the APS level, because I know, you know, I get the emails from APS, I get the American Federation of Scientists emails of, you know, do this advocacy, and I got to admit, a lot of times I'm already having a day with 10 things on fire, and it doesn't get done. That sort of takes us into a different question of like, how do we promote engage, that I think you guys had on your list of how do we promote engagement with these advocacy efforts?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times for these issues that do impact our field, but they're not HEP specific. I do generally think the APS advocacy efforts are the more appropriate, you know, mechanism to deal with those. One, because of what Corinne mentioned, you know, they've got a louder bullhorn than we do. And secondly, because they have the infrastructure and staff to, you know, to deal with those. I mean, if we want to have HEP make a parallel set of, you know, advocacy efforts for, you know, immigration or what have you, that APS is already doing, then we have to provide the manpower to do that, right? We have to, you know, the folks on the, you know, that organize and run the DC trip, you've just upped their workload by a lot. And so, you know, are we willing to invest the resources in, you know, putting more people to work on that when APS is already doing it, right? And so that's one of the arguments for, you know, sort of restricting our efforts primarily to HEP specific things. But there are the gray areas, right? I mean, there are like the things Corinne mentioned about, you know, what about a lab overseas if there's a restriction for preventing travel coming in? It makes it, you know, harder or impossible for us to run our experiments, to have enough people to run shifts, right, in some cases. And so that's a specific HEP impact of immigration policy that really is somewhat different than some of the other physics. So there are cases where it comes in. But generally, you know, in a lot of cases for these other issues, I think APS would be the appropriate venue. Also, because speaking to a point Mateus made earlier, you know, a lot of these decisions on advocacy for APS, you know, the leadership of APS sort of comes up with a statement and they pass it and they put it out and they don't pull everybody on it, right? But the thing is, APS has, you know, rules and procedures and mechanisms outlined in the Constitution and bylaws of the organization that empower those people to do it. So when you're joining APS, you're saying, yes, I want those people to make those decisions. We have no such mechanism in HEP. About the only way you could conceive of it being put in is not by individual user groups, because as Louise mentioned, those are, you know, fragmented, but if it was done at the DPF level. But the DPF is not going to just replicate another layer of what the APS organization is already doing. Not to mention, they have no staff or funding to, you know, to carry that out. And so, again, it comes to, you know, defining the mechanisms and how, you know, and putting that up ahead of time and up front.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe even like you guys made good points, like the way I said, maybe even sounded like APS is this government of physicists that represent us all. Like we know it's not. But it's true, like to get to the DPF level, it's somewhat the group that more explicitly represent us. And if we want to do an extra level of advocacy that is more than what APS does, I think, well, I'm not sure if that's a consensus, but I think it would be not hard to say that just the statement doesn't really do that much. And if there are things that we care about, we really should do an extra work. But yeah, and we need people power to do those things. One thing is that like the DC trip, it's not really something that we do as part of our job descriptions, right? Like, that is already something that is in most cases considered an extra thing that we do. And that funding and that structure that exists, it it was put it together over time because that was something that we somewhat decided that was important. So I don't think it is that impossible for us to organize in a way that they're right, like we could come together with a group that do organize such, just say randomly, a second type of DC trip that uses part of the structure that exists for the main DC trip. And that one could try to advocate for specific things, right? Like to, and some of the things can be shared with no harm at all. Like the website where we organize the meetings, if it's not being used during February and March, I don't think it's no harm for us to use some sort of the same structure to a different DC trip that have completely parallel and different goals than the first one. Or, right, like we don't need to up the work of the people that are organizing the one DC trip. We can just have a second group that could come together from the same users' communities that where the first one comes from. You know, so I completely agree that we need to define and create those things, but I think a lot of the structure already exists. It's just a matter of we really standing up and saying we care about these specific things enough to do more than just write letters saying I don't like what you're doing.
Yeah, you. There's something that I think is pervasive in some in our conversation, which is like our own engagement, like the engagement of our own community, and you know, like. It's through, I mean, doing any type of advocacy, do any type of advocacy or even things that are not necessarily science, which like, for example, physics outreach and stuff like that, takes time. And like Corinne was saying, I sometimes don't get to that because I have 300 emails and I'm running around putting fires out. I have to say that it needs to start with us, meaning it needs to start to for us looking back to the way that we looking back at what we think it's important. And I've had there have been a number of mentors. And you know, like higher ups in my career that were really pushing me to get into advocacy or outreach and such like and stuff like that. But there have been basically the same number of people that have told me, don't do outreach, don't do advocacy, it does nothing for your career. And in some sense they're both right, meaning that I think that making advocacy, like doing advocacy, doing outreach makes you a better physicist because you're able to, like, the communication in science is fundamental, it's really, and it's not very well regarded, meaning that I think it's really important that you say clearly what you're doing. And this is true either for policies, but also for, you know, like explaining the cross-section of pi and interaction. And so it does, like it does have an impact, but it's also true that in the field, we don't regard advocacy and outreach and everything that is not science, like not writing a paper, as a waste of time. And so like until we don't look at engagement and outreach as a part of our job, as a part of our community, something that it's important on a CV when you're hiring somebody, what's the point? Like no one has free time here. And so like when I say it starts with us, it starts with the supervisors, it starts with your local group. That's what I mean. Like if we don't give importance to these things and give, like allow the people that work with us to do it within their time that they work, then you're always be short on people, your advocacy is not going to be as effective because you're doing it on people's spare time.
So that quite well brings us into the kind of the last question we had written down, which is, you know, as a community, we've developed this machinery as we've mentioned multiple times, to, you know, effectively facilitate budget advocacy. So, you know, as Mateus was just mentioning, do we think we should be using that same machinery for these advocacy topics? And then there's additional concern, as as Eleanor was just mentioning, that this has a tendency to split resources. So this has, from the traditional advocacy, and has two points. One, this is both in terms of the potential impact of that advocacy, would splitting our efforts in some way, do we think that would have a possible negative impact on the current advocacy, and this question of resources that are available, which is both in terms of, you know, people resources, personnel, and in terms of other financial and government relation expertise, which there are things that we, the trip to DC is obviously not free. We actually spend a lot of money on that, both in terms of printing resources and in terms of providing travel support for people. So there's another question about splitting those resources, or even if the resources we probably have right now may not, probably wouldn't be able to be used for other efforts. I think, Eleanor, it's your turn to...
Yeah. So I think Mateus has covered part of this, meaning that there's some of the machinery that it's in place, it's easily reusable. For example, the website is fantastic, and it's definitely something that can be reused without additional. I think you can do it in a smart way. Like, I think you can do it in an efficient way. There's a few points. One is, again, this can be done in a fairly efficient way. Two, it's true that it requires resources and people time. And that part is definitely the more complicated because again, like, I don't think that we have enough people that care about issues that they don't even understand that these issues are important for our field. Like, they don't understand the importance of having, they can be sympathetic to the fact that you're going through something very difficult, but the fact that we could do something about it as a field never crossed their mind. There's a third point, which I think it's, I don't know, maybe it's me being cynical. We do a very good job at the DC trip because what we are putting forward is a really nonpartisan issue. And we go there, we show our excitement for science, and even when we do the worst type of advocacy, we don't listen to them, we just show that we are excited, we are not saying anything particularly controversial, and so we are received quite well. And I'm just saying that I have been, and I've seen people being pretty bad advocates, but we're being pretty bad advocates on something that is easy to like. And doing advocacy on things that are not necessarily these, like, that can be controversial, it's very difficult, and you need to be very smart about it, and people make career out of them. So while I think that some of the machinery is there and it's it can be reusable, again, like, we need to put more attention into why these things are important to us, get more people to understand that the people in our field are actually matter, and to do a better job into how to do advocacy. In terms of, I honestly think that that the DC trip is not the place to do this type of advocacy. One would do another dedicated DC trip because it's already difficult to get, like, the amount of information that you can give in the 15 minutes that you talk to them, it's really limited. Like, you have the ask, and most of the people that are, like, most of the staff just looks for the ask, and okay, what's like, they write down a number, and that is what they care about, adding information that can be controversial to begin with, it's not, I don't think it's the way to go.
Yeah, I think that Elena makes some very, very strong points about wading in this. And one of the biggest is the training aspects of it. When it is easy to advocate for nonpartisan issues that everybody likes, it is very difficult to advocate for controversial issues. And it takes a lot of training. It takes people that really, really, really know what they're doing. And the number of people in our field that would meet that bar, you could probably count on one hand, maybe. And certainly not me. And so that's a huge, huge hurdle in trying to do this. The resource question is big. There are many costs involved. The DC trip is not cheap. And we get a lot of funding resource from the URA to carry it out. The odds of the URA even being able to fund an additional trip for other things, let alone would they want to, because it might jeopardize their, if they start advocating, if the URA starts advocating for some controversial issues, they might start losing support for renewing their contract to run the lab, right? So even if they wanted to, do they have the resources to fund a whole nother trip? Probably not, which means if we want to do another separate trip to advocate for other things, it's going to come at the expense of the DC trip. It would definitely come at the expense of the DC trip. That's the pot of money they would get the resources for. And so we would have less of an impact for that advocacy that we already do very well. So that will suffer. The other thing is the cost to the even if we were to do it at the same level, the cost to the effectiveness and how well we're received. One of the reasons why we get such a strong, overwhelming, broad bipartisan support is the fact that when we come and advocate for things, it doesn't cost the individual people, the representatives and such, much in politically, right? Because everybody's on board with this, essentially. And they like hearing from us. They like supporting us because it gets them brownie points with everybody, right? Not big ones, but it gets them little brownie points with everybody. But now if we come and start advocating for some controversial issues, whichever way it goes, you're going to lose the support of some segment of the people you're trying to reach, right? You're going to lose for that issue. They don't agree with you on that issue, and so you're going to lose some support there. Well, it's still the same folks asking this, right? So that office is going to say, these HEP people want me to do this thing that I really disagree with. And so that's going to tinge the reception you get when you come to talk, about the funding. And so it will impact our effectiveness on that level as well. APS doesn't, when it's done at the APS level, there's not as much cost to the organization there because they've got a louder voice. They've got a bigger lever. And so they're not as easy to just dismiss over a disagreement on a given issue, which we don't have. We don't have that luxury. So there are real costs in doing it. I think we need to be careful about that. And, doesn't mean that there's not an issue that comes up that, as Corinne mentioned, back in with the Jewish immigrants and all that, there doesn't mean that there's not going to be an issue that we think is important enough. You know what? We still have to make a statement, even though this is going to hurt. But you've got to do it knowing those costs. And the other thing that I wanted to mention on this is, as you were talking about different advisors and all of this, and having a culture where the community really demonstrates that it cares about these things and shows that. There's something, one of the things I've been saying off and on since I've been in this role as a CEF co-convener is just sort of putting out the sort of reality of our field, of the field as a whole and its attitudes towards, community engagement issues, whether it's government or D&I or education and outreach, whatever they are, all of them. As a whole, our field doesn't care. There are an extremely small number of people within our field that are actively engaged in any of these issues of CEF. A very small percentage of our field is. And the general attitudes that I perceive behind the lack of participation breaks down into two groups. And it's basically senior versus junior. For the junior folks, what seems to be the hurdle is the things that Elena was mentioning, that, if I do this, it's not going to help my career. And in many cases, depending on my advisor and who I'm applying to, it's an actual detriment. It holds it back. And that's real. And so that prevents a lot of early career folks from really getting involved much. But on the senior side, it's worse. And that is the senior side, the majority opinion, whether it's conscious or not, is let somebody else deal with it. I've got important research to do. And so the field leaves it to a very small handful of people to take care of this. And that's what they're going to do with these issues as well, right? Oh, we've got this mechanism. We've got these things. Those DC trip people already do this. So yeah, fine. Go advocate for some other things. And so basically they dump it on Justin and Fernand and everything to retool whips to be able to handle other issues and letter writing campaigns that it doesn't already. So it's not really that the machinery is just ready to turn the crank there. It's ready to turn the crank for the kind of DC trip funding advocacy that we do. It's not ready to turn the crank on these other types of things. And our field is perfectly fine to just dump that in the lap of two or three people and make them do it and let their career suffer, because I've got important work to do. And that is our community. I mean, I can say it just that bluntly. These issues, our field doesn't care.
Yeah. I think it's really well put, and I'll be very quick. In both cases, it boils down to incentives. For junior people and for senior people, advocacy, outreach, these things are not rewarded.
So yeah, right. So what we are asking is somewhat of a cultural change. So this needs to start somewhere. I completely agree with all that Breeze just said, but I would not be the person that takes all of that and say, okay, so we don't do anything. Organizations like this right now are the type of discussions that we need to have to try to start changing that conversation. If a generation ago, people didn't say the things that Ellen had mentioned, and had said, like, you know what, do some advocacy, even if it's not great for your career, we would be in a completely different position, right? Yeah. So sure, we all need to weight the things that we want and we don't want to do, right? Like we have a giant culture of we should be working 24/7, right? Like we're not even choosing what we do with our free time. We are choosing here to not work in our free time to do some advocacy, right? Like, so there is a problem with our culture in many ways. So I think that's the point. I completely agree when we talk about structure that things are not completely ready to go, but I think we can still not that hardly get into that be ready to go. Some of the structure. I know we're gonna compare all of this with the DC trip, of course, But this needs to be a completely different thing, right? Like we can't even use the same strategies. I don't think we're gonna go into every single office in Congress to talk about LGBTQ rights, and we're just gonna be kicked out of that, right? Like that doesn't work like that. It needs to be done in a strategic way. It needs to be done in offices where you can try to turn that crank in some way that is efficient. So yeah, and when we talk about training and we talk about strategy, you need money and you need time to make all these things happen. So yeah, all of these are true. All of this is true, and we need to think about all of that. There is, and I maybe something that I want to propose that may be some sort of a parallel conversation, a parallel solution to this. But one thing that I learned while we do the DC trip and this advocacy, the structure in the organization, it exists, but in the end, when I call a congressperson office to schedule a meeting, and when I go there to talk, I'm still doing that as a person, right? Like, I get there and we are organized to have the same speech and to talk about the same things and say, hey, I'm representing HEP. But at the same time, I could grab my phone and try to schedule something and try to go there to talk about something that I personally care. So one thing that we can also do is to somewhat make structure available in the sense that we can organize as people and not to go and say, hey, eight, right? Like, I don't know, you can get as specific as you can, as Breeze started perfectly. There is an unlimited number of things that you can fight for. If I talk about, I don't know, how Trump's endangered trans homeless people in urban areas. That is, of course, not something that we're going to get consensus that it affects HEP in general, but it's definitely something that I care personally and I would be happy to fight for. If there is some sort of structure that exists for me to find other people in this community that want to fight for that, and then we can organize ourselves to make that happen, I think that that's something that can easily be done just somewhat using the funding and structure that we have that allow us to do that, right? Like I can't make a listserv to have this discussion, but we can somewhat find another resource to make that discussion happen. And that's something that wouldn't be dangerous in that way of like spoiling the HEP name, but it still would give people the power to organize themselves and fight for things that they think are important personally. And this, again, this may be some sort of a parallel thing, right? Like I definitely think there are things that we want to fight as HEP, but I don't think it's that hard to give people the structure for them to organize in a personal level.
So we're just a little bit behind schedule. We scheduled a couple minute break now because our panelists have been talking for quite a while. So everyone wants to take just like 2 minutes to grab a glass of coffee, maybe a cup of coffee or a glass of water, eat those. And then we're gonna open up to general conversation and questions from everyone online. So I'll just leave things running and then we will start the conversation again, let's say at 20 past, 10:20 or 20 past whatever hour time zone you currently are in. Okay, well, it's 20 minutes past, so we can get started again. I know that, Corinne, you had a question, so we can start off with that. If she's back.
Yes. And I thought more about it, and I'm not actually sure it's applicable in this domain, but I'll just float it anyways. And actually, as long as I have the floor, can I just, I wanted to add at the end of the last thing after Brisa's point about stuff, I want to actually add a note of hope, which is that I think the culture is slowly shifting. When I see, because the impression I have, and I realize also I'm one of the most senior people on this call, and I think there is a, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, there wasn't this need to advocate for our field. So that wasn't part of the culture. And so, yes, it's the young people now who are doing it, and the senior people, you know, I think Bree summed it up really well. Like, oh, well, I have important research to do. But, you know, as all the people who are here now who are going on the DC trip, you know, we think this is important. We've invested our time in it. And, like, my opinion on that is not changing as I move from postdoc to faculty. And then when my students talk about doing this, you know, I'm like, you know, my postdoc expressed interest in doing the DC trip someday. I said, you know, it's a really great thing to do. It takes up a lot of time, but like, if you want to do that, I'll support it. I think the culture will slowly change.
Yeah, and I agree. I think it is. And I am hopeful for it. And, you know, for example, I mean, one of the kinds of issues that I think it would probably make sense for us to pursue is, you know, dealing with some kind of advocacy to alter the grant process and how it's done within DOE, right? I mean, NSF it requires you to have this, this, you know, sort of education and outreach component to any grant. DOE doesn't. That, now we know why that's the case. There's a very specific reason why it's the case, and it's the defined legislative mission of each agency. But trying to get requirements into grant proposals that deal with community engagement issues that put some teeth to this needs to be part of our jobs, and so things like that. But yes, I am hopeful that it is changing. But those are the kind of hurdles that we're dealing with.
I'll just inject into that, sorry, I can't raise my hand, that there's a joint topic between the public education and outreach group and this topical group to discuss exactly what Brees just pointed out, which is if any avenue exists for modifying the DOE granting criteria to include some support for outreach activities.
And one of the things that that I think is important in that is, and this goes to something that I don't know how many of you have seen Alan Stone's presentation, where he there's a section on it, he both in his general for the HEPPI meeting, and then he had a sort of separate session I think at HEPAP about D&I, and he went through some really good points. But one thing that it included there was one of the things that we, you know, that people in communication, education, and outreach and stuff have, you know, often said is, oh, you know, everybody should, you know, be involved in this and all. And then, you know, D&I, oh, everybody should be involved in D&I. Oh, you know, everybody should be involved in, you know, advocacy. Oh, there are many different kinds of community engagement where, you know, these topics, whether it's applications in industry or D&I topics and working on those policy changes or advocacy or education and outreach or these things. We can't expect everybody to be involved in every type of, you know, activity, and nor should they, because there are people that are very good at advocacy, but they stink at, you know, diversity and inclusion type of things, or, you know, they care about this, but they're not very good at it, but this is something they're really effective at. But something, everybody should be involved in some type of activity, engagement activity that benefits the field as a whole, as opposed to your specific research. And so, you know, NSF, it's very targeted to education outreach, right? Because that's part of their mission. DOE's got nothing because it, none of them are part of their mission. But you know, one of the things to that I think is important if we go along those lines is to make sure that it's not just stovepiped into one specific aspect that everybody has to get involved in that and all the rest of them get left behind. So.
Yeah, just to bring up one point that we didn't got to, but I think it fits this conversation, but maybe it goes more out the venue that Rob mentioned with the relation of this group with the public outreach. Because another thing that it's also a non-funding government outreach that the things that we can do are relating to more into trying to educate politicians into science, right? Like that's something that may be less controversial. And they're also useful to just try to create venues where we can, and then to the point of only talking about science, but it's still like using some structure that we can to create this educational bridge between us and policymakers. That's something that it could also be very interesting, and it fits in the non-funding outreach as well.
Okay, I want to open it up for anyone other than our panelists to ask any questions that they have or make any comments, just to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to speak. Well, I don't see any hands or anyone unmuting, so go ahead, Brees, but I'll be keeping an eye in case anyone wants to
please.
Chime in.
one thing to address the sort of the culture and the mechanisms part of it is I think that the way to change the culture and to be able to develop mechanisms, I think the SNOMAS process is the way to do that. In particular, if folks want to expand what, you know, our field, specific field of HEP does in terms of advocacy, then there has to be a proposal for how to do it. And so somebody's got to write a white paper. You know, you need to write a white paper laying out this is the mechanism, you know, I think here are the reasons why I think HEP needs to do it, as opposed to working through APS, you know, to deal with these other issues, why it's needed for HEP community specifically to do it as opposed to APS, make that argument and defend that. And then, you know, lay out way a proposal for how that might be done. Is it going to be done similar to the DC trip, where basically you just get the users groups together and informally, you know, come up with a plan to do it, you know? Or is it going to be starting a new, you know, a new organization or something within our field? I mean, we've already got DPF elected representatives. Is it for DPF to do it? Or are we going to do another elected, you know, parallel organization to DPF and, you know, multiply the bureaucracy of our field and everything to handle this? So, you know, how is it going to be done? Who's going to do it? And, and how are they going, what's the mechanism for giving them the mandate to do that? You know, draft some bylaws. If you think a new organization needs to be formed outside of DPF, APS, and the user groups, draft, you know, a constitution and bylaws for them, how they're going to operate, how they're going to be elected, you know, that type of thing. And then, you know, what are the bylaws for how they're going to make these decisions? What's going to set consensus? Who's, you know, how is that going to be, polled? How is it going to be given? Or is it just going to be delegated to the hands of whoever was elected to this new organization for them just to make the decision? Write that out specifically. And so a proposal has to be made for why something is needed. What's the way to, you know, who's the person or people to do it, and how are they going to do that? Yeah.
I'll just go. I don't know if Luis can see my physically raised hand. So I think that makes a lot of sense, Brees. Although an observation I would make is that I guess I don't know this for a fact, but I don't think that's how we arrived at the current situation that we have for funding related advocacy.
That's true.
I think this is exactly the way that is appropriate to move forward. But we're currently using a system that has grown much more organically. And I guess without going too much into what we currently do for funding specifically, but on this topic, do you think that the existing system that we have for developing a mandate on the funding related advocacy is sufficient? And I guess this is a question to all panelists. If we're thinking about this alternate style of advocacy or topics for advocacy and looking at what we do currently, should we be rethinking this from the ground up as something that would support both categories of advocacy? Or are we totally content with what we have existing?
Well, the one response to that is that, okay, so you write a white paper for what you think needs to be done, but we need to expand in this. Okay, so how do we do it? One option is to create some new organization to do it. One option is to just say, okay, make the DPF do it. Or one option is more along the lines of what you just mentioned there, our existing structure, the user groups, right? I mean, that's how we do it. It's done through the user groups, and they informally, there's no rules for how to do this, but they informally cooperate to do this. Well, your white paper proposal may be just let the users groups, you know, do this just like they've done for the DC trip. That that's the people to do it, and that's the way to do this as well. But you're right that the DC trip function has grown organically. You know, it started decades ago when the field was much, much smaller and much, much more able to just sort of get together and say, hey, let's put on a show, you know. But that's been in place for decades, and the field now acknowledges that that's the mechanism by which we do this, right? I mean, to my knowledge, I don't think that there has been a movement, you know, brought to the users group saying, hey, you guys are doing this wrong and you need to change because I'm tired of you guys making the decisions here and running this show yourself. So I think just over the history of the decades that our field is very comfortable with how this is being carried out. But my guess is that when you start going into potentially controversial topics, there's not going to be so much unanimity because there are going to be people that say, I mean, there are not too many people in the field that are going to say, you know what, I'm tired of you guys going and get more money for our field, right? I don't like that you're doing that. But if you go into other issues, even if, like Louise mentioned earlier, even if they agree in principle about the issue itself, there could be very strong disagreements about what is the legislative mechanism to address it. And so if we do it organically, like we have in the past, on something that there's going to be potentially significant disagreement on within the field, there's going to be a lot of, you know, unhappy people. And so I think that's why I think going into these areas, yes, you are going to need to start defining very specific mechanisms for how this is done on the front end, because it's not part of the mandate that we've had before, and it's something that's going to be, potentially areas of significant disagreement.
I wanted to know what Herman thinks about this because he was there.
Yeah.
I just wanted to I agree with what you're saying, Breeze, and I think that's a very, very, very good point. I just want to point out that there was one instance over the last 30 years or so in which there was discord with the high-energy physics community and the other physics community, and that was the SSC.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people outside in condensed matter physics and various other places actually were very critical of the high-energy physics community because we were sucking in an enormous amount of government and international money to put together the SIC, and it failed. Some of the work that I think has developed in essentially fine-tuning the DC trip came out of an understanding in 1993, and about that time, that we were doing a very poor job in making advocacy for our field in Washington and among the decision makers. And so you're correct, the work that we have done and has been done over those past 30 or 40 years is in fact to fine tune this to a point where nobody, and you're correct, Breeze, would ever say that we're doing a bad job or that in fact, this is not the way in which you actually advocate for your field. It may be that I think from listening what you guys have to say, it is true that because of the success of the DC trip and the success of this advocacy for HEP, a lot of other people might say, let's use that particular mechanism to advocate for other activities. And if you do that independently, you're probably doing okay. But I think my attitude is to make sure that you understand the playing field that you're in. It's a minefield. It's very, very sensitive in a lot of ways. I've been in some meetings where I'm talking about particle physics and they're listening to me and they're listening very carefully. Jerry Nadler, in fact, I remember very, very well. And after I finished, he asked me if I was going to support or ask him for money for the ILC. And he had already made up his mind that he didn't want to give any money for the ILC. And I had not talked about the ILC at all. So the level of sophistication in terms of overlapping that, and his concern was not physics. His concern was international cooperation on high energy physics projects. And, you know, once you get outside of our little sweet spot, so to speak, it becomes a very treacherous territory. So you have to be extremely careful about, as Breeze has said, about whether in fact you're going to be supported or not supported because of some advocacy that someone might have. And particularly today, in terms of all the social concerns that we have around the world for that matter, whether in fact the HEP standing on some platform is the proper way in which for to make an advocacy for the field versus an advocacy for human rights or something of that sort. Andre Sakharov, and you know, you remember all of the old stories of what was going on in some governments around the country, around the world, that did not allow people to have the sort of free rein to engage in science, and particularly the questions about science these days for global climate change and for, you know, inoculations. You know, you're in a very sensitive spot, and we've shown that we can actually get the money for high energy physics. You have billion-dollar budgets, which I never would have dreamed of 20 years ago, and it's a different set of eyes that look at you when you get past that particular number. But when you start thinking about adding something to the dynamics that you already have and successful, you have to be really, really careful, because we've done this for a very long time. And believe me, certainly in the time that I think my first visit to Washington was 1993. And I'll tell you, what I have felt very strongly is that over the years, we have refined ourselves to a point where we can put everything that we know into a successful advocacy for high energy physics. When you add something to that, it should actually benefit high energy physics, independent of the fact that we have our emotions associated with just being decent human beings and trying to make the world a decent place. Hopefully particle physics actually does that, or at least contributes to it. But that might be another question, actually. But thanks very much for your discussion. I'm overwhelmed with I've been on two snow masses and also engaged as part of my work in snow mass for this kind of discussion, advocacy, STEM education, and so forth. And you guys are doing it, I think, better than we ever thought we could even think about doing it in the past. So I appreciate that.
Thanks, Herman. Corinne, I saw your hand go up briefly. I don't know if your point was made or you still wanted to chime.
Yeah, it's hard to follow up Herman's points there, but it actually touches a bit on what Breeze said. my question was, you know, we focused very much on advocacy to the legislative branch of government, and you know, very, and very successfully in the case of funding. But one thing I've thought about over the years is, you know, are there, you know, they're not the only ones who make decisions about how things get done, and policy in particular. And I've wondered if there is a, if there is use for advocating to the executive branch of government and what the mechanism for that even would be. And as long as I'm making very broad questions, Herman's comments even to me raise the point of like, is there a role for advocating for more discussion with other branches of physics, because there can be a lot of misunderstandings between the different subfields, which have very different cultures. I have no answers. That's my question.
I guess we definitely have started the conversation about additional advocacy to the executive branch. So either different advocacy on to the DOE and NSF, and that comes more to what we were discussing earlier about whether or not we can change the DOE grant requirements, specifically has come up, and, you know, competitive reviews in the DOE. Within the OMB and the OSTP, right? The OSTP, you know, we've seen a lot of executive orders which have come out in the last 4 years, at least, I don't know, I guess I haven't actually checked. In my, from my perspective, it seems like there's been more executive orders in the last 4 years which have impacted high energy physics. Specifically, the one that comes to mind is the more recent ones about AI and QIS, which have stepped us away from what we were doing in SNOMAS. And, you know, that is in some ways to be expected because, you know, quantum computing is moving so quickly. But when that came out, it was a very large pot of money that an executive order put that we were going to spend on that area and change the budget requirement. And, you know, the both of the agencies had to respond to that. You know, we have a meeting with the OMB and the OSTP during the trip to DC, but we don't really have a, you know, a mechanism for like ongoing outreach to it, nor is it particularly clear that that meeting is the most effective. So it's something that's very much, you know, it's been on my mind. It's not quite, you know, it's something that we've been thinking about generally within this group, but I don't think we have any answers.
Well, in terms of using existing mechanism, you know, as I mentioned earlier, if we go to, you know, legislative advocacy for other issues, you know, whether we do it at the same time of the DC trip or we do it at a different time of the year, it's going to impact the response we get on the funding. It will. And on the other hand, you know, Kryn talking about advocating to the executive branch, if you think specifically about the agencies, you know, we have these meetings with DOE and NSF every year on the trip. I would imagine that that there could be ways to use those meetings more effectively for us. I mean, it's been a long time since I've been in those meetings. You know, it's been years since I've been in those meetings. But when I was years ago, they were essentially just, we give them feedback on how our trip's been going and what we've been hearing in meetings and things like that. That's essentially what it was. That's right. Sort of a debriefing for them. But, you know, I would imagine that those meetings could be used, you know, to coherently, from the representatives of the grassroots field, DOE, this is what we think needs to be changed in the grant process. You know, NSF, this is what, you know, we think is a concern with how D&I is being done, you know, within the agency, you know, and that would not have the kind of, you know, sort of negative impact on what the rest of the trip is doing like it would if we were advocating for other issues to congressional offices. So that might be, you know, an avenue that we could expand what we're doing on issues. But again, even to do that, you know, we would need some kind of mechanism for determining what issues, and I think it would need to be something more than just the users group saying, oh, this is what our message is going to be for the trip. I think it would have to be a more explicit feedback from the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, those meetings have been somewhat more one way recently. You know, it's very much a tell us, you know, that the agencies don't have that many mechanisms to actually talk to Congress. So they really want to, you know, they use it as a means to, you know, get the temperament and, you know, the water temperature on the hill. And it's not being used for that mechanism, right? And it definitely, you know, it could be, but there would need to be an additional effort for us to come. So we don't, again, it goes back to the larger conversation, right? You know, it's easiest to say, we came here, we asked for this amount of money, as this breakdown, as Snowmass recommends we spend the money. And we went to Congress and they were happy, not happy about it, but the budget was going to be passed. And it's not really generally a statement about how much they like our funding. It's generally just a statement about, oh, 90% of officers think it's going to be a continuing resolution. So I think those they in some ways get more of those meetings than we do. We would need to, again, go back into this topic. We need to have a mechanism ahead of time to decide within the community what changes we want to ask from the agencies. There is some additional conversation as well to even understand what is possible, you know, going back to the DOE and grants. You know, it's not clear that providing the DOE feedback that we want this is actually the best mechanism, right? That's something that would need to be legislated and not just reported back. Mm-hmm. You know, other areas about whether or not review processes or PI meetings or the breakdown within the non-line item budget, you know, this is specific feedback that we could be providing to the agencies, but we would need to make sure there would need to be a lot of discussion and mechanism for a community agreement for those areas ahead of time. And this again isn't something that we have. It's a lot more complicated to, you know, the great thing about the P5 is it does lay out an amount, an understanding for project spending, and we can bring that to Congress. If we want to start discussing the breakdown of non-project based spending, this is something that's come up more recently about, you know, amount of money that goes to research or to other areas. And we want to bring that to the agencies, you know, that's a far more complicated conversation. And it's a far more complicated conversation within the NSF than the DOE, where again, more money is line items. In the NSF, they have a lot of flexibility. You know, how do you, you know, do you go to those meetings to try and persuade overall within the NSF that more money should be directed towards high energy physics projects, towards other projects? And again, that's not something that we currently do. And would need, you know, again, these additional efforts and mechanisms ahead of time in order to work out what the message would be and what we would, you know, how we would sell it. Mateus?
So I want to make another comment about this.
I don't see any hands, so.
Sorry, I had my hand.
Oh, you had your physical hand. I can't see your physical hand.
And then I didn't hear what Mateus said. I was going to change the topic. So Mateus, if you're following on this thought.
I think you're both going to change the topic.
Yeah, it's because, well, we're getting close to the end, and I think I want to allow myself to make a big and probably very naive comment about this whole thing. Which, like, it's my personal opinion. I think part of the problem, it's how much we keep measuring the success of this community related to the amount of money we get, right? We get billions of dollars, and that's true, and that's amazing, that's great, but that's also somewhat sacrificing a lot of things that are related to the social side of this community, right? Like, a lot of problems that we have in that sense comes from this mentality that we need to do better and bigger science. Well, better is already a term, but like maybe bigger science, and we need to do it as fast as possible, and we need the most money we can get to do that tomorrow. And I personally don't agree with that. I mean, if we, and just being completely utopic, but if I am in a community where immigrants can feel safer to be around and don't have the amazing personal struggles that people need to go through to work on this community. And then if it takes us extra 10 years to find out the sterile neutrino, I'm personally okay with that. And back to what Breeze mentioned before, it may be the case that this community in general just don't care for it, and it's fine. And maybe I'm the one that's in the wrong place. But I feel that this narrative that we are successful because we get more and more money, it's true. We are successful in getting money. We're successful in getting funding. But we're not really successful as a community if those things are somewhat to the detriment of the people that work or that want to work or that could possibly bring amazing things into the community. Mm-hmm.
Rob, I don't know if anyone wants to respond to that, or Rob, I know you had a different comment.
I do have a different comment. I completely agree with Mateus, though, and one of the things I've been thinking about during this conversation is how, you know, at some level, I am personally discouraged from continuing on in this field if we as a community don't prioritize certain aspects of the conversations we've been having. And that certainly, you know, as I look towards what my future plans are, it's a very real criteria for me personally that the community I'd become a part of, whether it's staying on in physics or going out into some other sphere, that it, you know, we take these things seriously. And it's not, you know, I understand that where things are currently and take that into consideration, but if there's not forward momentum and serious investment into some of these issues, that is a serious consideration for me staying on in the field. And I think that's true of a lot of my early career colleagues. Maybe I'll hold off on my separate question as a follow-up thought.
You know, my response to that and to Mateus as well, both of those comments is the way forward is start with a white paper. You know, start with a real white paper that documents and lays out the arguments and presents solutions. Make it good, get support for it, get co-authors for it. Get that, you know, within the relevant topical groups report. And, you know, for that to be, you know, for those ideas to be incorporated into the Snowmass reports. So that will be a statement, you know, of at least how a significant segment of this community feels about it, right? Because if it's gone through the topical group process, you know, to get that support and be written into the report, it goes into the frontier to be part of the report and, you know, recommendations and things to reach that level. And then the next thing is, you know, to make that argument strong in the reports so that it's something that P5 pays attention to, right? So there, you can look at the old P5 report, right? It's got a whole long list of recommendations in different areas. Not a whole lot of recommendation in the P5 about anything to do with community engagement issues, right? A whole lot about physics, but nothing about community engagement. And what does that mean? That in the last Snowmass, we thought our community is just satisfactorily engaged on everything and there's nothing to be done? No, it's that we didn't care about that. It was not important to us as a field. Well, is it going to be important enough to us as a field for people to write white papers on it? Is it going to be important enough to us as a field to have that featured in our reports? Is it important enough as a field for us to be able to say, P5, look at what's in this report, you know, address it and get recommendations out of P5. So then if you've got a P5 report and yeah, we're going to, you know, prioritize, you know, getting Dune. Yeah, we're going to prioritize the next, you know, dark matter experiments. Yeah, we're going to prioritize this, but we're also going to prioritize getting our house in order. We're also going to prioritize, you know, engaging with our community more and having a bigger impact on our community. This is going to be part of what our role is as, you know, this is part of our 20-year vision for HEP, not just the paper we're going to publish, but how we're going to be as a community, both internally and externally. Those are goals of our field. And when they're stated as such, and in those things, when you go to apply for a job, here's P5 recommendation number 2. This is how my research addresses it. Here's P5 recommendation number 10 on community engagement. Here's how my career is going to address it. Then that's something that can be evaluated against what is prioritized in the field. And working towards getting those things institutionalized, that to be, you know, a worker in this field, you're going to have to spend some time working on some of these things, right? And so if that's part of grant writing, then when you go to apply for a job, right, I gotta, you know, show the selection committee that I'm going to be, you know, have a good opportunity to get funded, right? Well, if I'm not going to do any education and outreach, I can't get any NSF funding, right? If I can't show that I can engage in that type of activity, I'm not going to get that funding. Well, right now, DOE, I don't have to do anything else except research to get that funding. And so that's what's going to have to happen. White mass, snow mass report, P5 recommendation. And that's how things are going to change in the culture.
Let me just point out that prior to P5, two snow masses ago, this was exactly the argument that was used for STEM education. Mm-hmm. And that now you see STEM is just a, you know, it's a watchword. Everybody has it in everything that's a part of it. But it was, Breeze, you're absolutely correct. Two snow masses ago in the 10, 15 years, whatever it was, it was actually put in that this was an important aspect of it. It was really a response to the fact that we had lost the SSC. But basically, that was one of those things that had nothing really to do with our basic HEP research, but it did have something to do with what people thought was an important aspect outside of HEP research. And now it's included in everything. So you're absolutely, that is exactly the right thing to do. And it'll take a little while.
Yeah.
And all I have to say is, Rob, hang in there.
So we're coming up on the hour. I want to make sure there's no one who hasn't had a chance to speak yet who has anything that they want to say. And if not, we probably have time for just one quick last comment, if anyone has anything. I know, Eleanor, you had your hand up earlier and then put it back down again. I don't know if anyone has any last closing statements they want to say.
Well, I can, maybe. I think, like, we talked about, you know, like, appealing to, like, the DC trip and appealing to bipartisan issues and such. I think that we are in a moment, it's an election year, and we are in a moment where, it's hard to be not engaged with the politics, or like we are going to have, I think in every international household, people are having the conversation, what are we gonna do? Depending on the outcome of the election. And so I wanted to point out that, like, politics, it is important for the lives of people that live here, and it does have an impact on our field, because it has a big impact on our people. And so it's, I think this is really good that we keep having these conversations, because again, the attitude of I'm gonna do my research, and yeah, somebody is going to give me funding. It can't fly.
Okay, well, it's coming up on 11 now. I want to thank all our panelists and our attendees for coming today. I thought we had some really good discussion. You know, I think we've basically determined it's a very complicated topic, and there's a lot of areas, you know, we weren't expecting to get an answer to it. That's not the point of these meetings. But thank you so much for spending your time to come here. I think it was a really good conversation, and I really enjoyed listening to all this today. So thank you.
Thank you for organizing.
Yeah, thanks everyone. Mm.
Thank you very much.
Nice discussion.
Thank you. It's been great to see everyone and have this interesting discussion.
Thanks, everyone. We'll post the recording on the Indigo page later today. Yes, thanks, everyone.
Well, bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.